It has happened before, yeah.
It's a strange day.
Yeah, well, we are. Yeah, well, okay. Namesake, nationality, that's, yeah.
Okay,
it
so
has happened before.
So, today we have Alejandro Sats from the University of Nottingham, and he will be telling us many interesting things about semiclassical limit of general triangulation, Regge calculus, and spin forms.
Yeah, okay, so. Well, he has already introduced me, but this is though I've been doing my PhD in the University of Nottingham. This is work I've been doing in a research visit to the CPT at Marseille and in collaboration with Eugenio Bianchi. It has appeared in the archive and it's going to appear in Nuclear Physics B. And so what will this be about? Okay. So what the general topic of this is an application of the general boundary formalism for quantum gravity, which is a formalism that is devised to solve a very general question that any background independent approach to quantum gravity has to face, which is how can a semiclassical limit making connection with perturbative theory about the background classical spacetime be recovered from a non-perturbative theory of quantum gravity, which knows nothing about any classical metric or spacetime or geometry of any kind. So a possible answer to this is general boundary formalism, which was devised by Urkel and Rovelli and several others. And very generally speaking, this is quite heuristic, but the general idea is that you do a non-perturbative path integral over geometries over a compact region of spacetime bounded by a three-dimensional geometry. And on that three-dimensional geometry, you put a quantum state psi, which is a functional of the boundary metric, three metric gamma. And you choose this boundary state psi to be picked on a classical three geometry Q, which you could do if you have some control of how your theory defines states on three geometries, such as the spin networks in loop quantum gravity. And then the idea is that this path integral, non-perturbative path integral over internal metrics, with this boundary state picked on the classical boundary geometry, will be equivalent in some sense to perturbative theory around a classical solution that matches this classical three geometry in the boundary. And so this is quite heuristic because we don't know how to do this integral over metrics, but it has a realization in spin-form models, which is what all these graviton propagators papers that have been circulating are about, like Leonardo has been working on this with Rovelli and several others. And the idea is to define that the thing that I had before as path integral for internal geometries as a spin form sum over internal spin forms bounded by a given spin network S, and then sum this over boundary spin networks with a boundary quantum state, which is a functional of spin networks, which is picked on a desired classical geometry Q. And the idea is to recover the perturbative graviton propagator somehow from this. And this has been done, there are lots of papers exploring this, especially for the Barrett-Crane model, and this is also a driving force behind the new models of spin forms. The general idea is to try to do this calculation for new spin form models. But so far, most of the calculations have been done only for a single simplex, like or in spin form term for a single spin form vertex, which is dual to a space-time simplex. And this is not very satisfactory because when you take a spin form single vertex, which is surrounded by the faces and edges, then those face and edge variables, the spins and intertwiners surrounding it, are just boundary variables. You only have boundary variables in the problem. You don't have any summation over internal variables. And so the non-perturbative aspect of the theory does not appear in some sense. So the question is whether this formalism does indeed work for a general triangulation. When you have many internal simplices, many internal spin-form vertices, many internal variables, which you have to sum over, and you pick explicitly with a boundary state only the boundary ones. So the question is whether this succeeds and how in this sense, in this setting for a general triangulation. And a related question to this one, which can be seen as a particular aspect of this question, has to do with the cosine problem of spin forms. So it is known that the large spin limit of a spin form vertex amplitude has to do with the cosine of the Regge amplitude for the corresponding geometry. and whereas what one would expect in the corresponding path integral of geometries is the exponential of the radiaction, not the cosine. So it is known that for a single simplex, its extra phase cancels when you use the boundary state formalism. This has been like sorted out in papers by Rovelli and his group. But the question is whether this still works when you have many simplices. So these are the questions that we want to address. And we are doing it in the framework of Regge calculus, which is better understood and more manageable than spin forms. So we are using Regge calculus as a testing ground, in a sense. We understand better Regge calculus, so we are using it to test this general boundary formalism and to see if it works as a previous step to using it in spin form. So in Regge calculus, we have simplicial geometries. This is a two-dimensional analog of what you were doing in four-dimensional Regge calculus. We are in the boundary formalism. We just do a restricted region. We have a boundary of it where we have edge lengths, big capital L, for variables. And the internal variables are the edge lengths, lowercase l. And the path integral sums over both boundary and internal edges with a suitable integration measure. An observable, which is a function of boundary geometry, and which is a function of the boundary edges Li. A quantum state, which is a function of the boundary edges Li. And the exponential of the Regge action for this configuration, which is just the sum of all the areas and deficit angles in this for the internal and boundary triangles. And so the idea is to do this path integral in Regge calculus and see whether it can match, whether the results when you have a boundary state that is peaked on a desired classical configuration can match those of conventional perturbative Regge calculus, where you fixed all the edges, both boundary and internal, and just quantize small fluctuations around them. Mm-hmm. So the boundary state that we have here, this psi q, we have to specify what we mean by this boundary state. How do we construct it? So the procedure is this. Since we want to match a desired classical solution on spacetime, we start with one classical solution on spacetime, both internal and external, both internal and boundary. And because that's what we're trying to achieve, to match this classical solution. So then we compute its extrinsic curvature, the derivative of the action with respect to the boundary edges, which is a set of numbers of parameters of the solution. And we construct a boundary state that includes, as parameters, the boundary edges of the solution and its boundary extrinsic curvatures, these parameters ki. And it's a Gaussian that is peaked on these boundary edges with a positive definite matrix alpha, or rather a matrix with positive definite real part, because it will also have an imaginary part in general. And the phase of the Gaussian, the phase factor, is given by this extrinsic boundary curvature k. And the reason to do it this way is that then the boundary state is peaked in both intrinsic and extrinsic boundary geometry, just as a Gaussian statement. Yes?
You're assuming to know the solution even in the bulk, you just said?
So I'm taking a classical solution everywhere, starting point, because the goal of this is to match perturbative theory around the classical solution that's known everywhere. So I'm taking a starting point that I know a classical solution.
In the bulk as well?
Yes, but I'm not using this as input. So what I'm using as input is the boundary parameters of the classical solution, which are the boundary L's and the boundary extrinsic curvatures K. And I put these in the boundary state, but I use a classical solution to compute them. So
is your solution in the bulk or just in the boundary?
In the bulk.
Yes. In the bulk.
Yes.
So if it's not a boundary state, it depends on the bulk as well.
No, the boundary. So the boundary state depends on the. So it's a function of boundary edges. So it's a boundary state. Okay. It has parameters. The parameters, which are numbers, if you want, are the Li nodes and the Ki nodes. So how do I decide which of these parameters are? I decide on a classical solution which I wish to reproduce, which I wish to reproduce perturbative theory around, and I choose as Li nodes its boundary edges, and as Ki nodes its boundary curvatures, its boundary these values, right? So from a classical solution that I know and that I wish to reproduce perturbative theory around, I compute as a set of numbers, two n numbers, where n is the number of boundary edges, right? And I use these numbers as input parameters in my boundary state. But the boundary state is a function of boundary edges only. That is why it's a boundary state.
The set of numbers could also come from a different choice in the bulk. I mean, you don't have control over that, right? You're seeing that, so you're choosing these boundaries on the solution on the classical solution such that at least one solution in the bulk exists. That's how you're constructing.
Yes.
However, it could be that these choices you've made for the boundary is also satisfied by a different bulk solution.
Well, we'll come to that discussion later, but.
I think
it's a coherent state, essentially. Well, I'm not sure if it's a coherent state in a technical sense. It's picked on a classical configuration.
I guess the question to follow up is, do you require that on a given, so you're doing Reggie calculus, so there's a given triangulation?
Yes, the triangulation is fixed.
Yes, and there are Reggie classical equations of motion. So you require that the L0 and K0 on the boundary edges have a property that they determine a solution of the Reggie equations of motion.
Yes, I am more or less assuming that, yes. And I agree that I do not have a proof that this boundary problem for Reggie is well defined. But if you want, I am restricting attention to solutions in which this boundary data are enough to determine the problem. And I think that is very plausible, because if it is not so, it will mean that you will need higher derivatives than the first two that to determine the solution, right? Which is not normal. So, and yes, I agree. But the assumption generally that sort of position and momentum are enough is quite normal.
Okay,
like,
so, okay. Oh, so there's first the other ones.
Yeah.
Say something.
Yeah. Can I say something else? If it was the case that this was not enough to specify a solution, you will need to increment your boundary state with more parameters enough to determine solution when we get to the stationary phase.
So I'm not so sure that it's actually reasonable to assume that the initial value problem in Reggie calculus is well defined. So that if you pick the boundary, you get a unique solution inside. But just to clarify what you're assuming in here now, I mean, at this stage, it doesn't look to me like you're assuming that is the case.
No, at this stage,
you're just
no.
Taking the classical
yes.
solution.
But I will assume it later. Yes, I will assume something similar to that later. I just want to make one comment, which is that the boundary problem is certainly not well defined when you have flat space inside, because then you can move points around, change the values of the edges, and this does not. There are several solutions, but this is sort of not relevant because they are all the same geometry, really, and we can deal with that. I will explain this later. So the question is whether there are really many physically distinct solutions compatible with not only boundary values of the L's but also of the extrinsic curvature, that is both Dirichlet and Neumann data at the same time. And I find it plausible that it's not, but if you think that it's plausible that there is, then if you want, I'm just restricting attention to cases in which this is true. And for cases in which this is not true, you will just need a more sophisticated boundary state.
This is the case where there's no solution.
Huh? Well, yes, I'm taking a starting point, a classical solution, so there is a solution.
just to clarify that. Mm-hmm. A solution to the Euclidean-Einstein equations in a compact four region with three boundary
mm-hmm.
is determined just by choice of three geometry.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say a solution, so that would be enough to have the
yes, yes.
So
the role of the case will be made clear later.
The assumption that the solution is determined by the L0s and the K0s are then really functions of the L0s.
Yes. So if Reggie calculus is nice as we would like it to be, and like as I'm hoping to be, the L0s are enough to determine a solution. But the K0s do have a very important role to play here, which will come later.
But then this is the assumption that this is defined not for any L0s and K0s, but for any L0s and K0s which are complicated functions. Of
yes. K0s. Yes. So if Reggie calculus has the nice properties that we would like it to have, the K0s are really functions of the L0s.
Good.
But I'm not necessarily assuming that. Like, actually, it might be the case that there are different solutions, and you need to specify like the momentum, like when you can go around the sun this way or the other. Like,
and
this, like,
but,
yeah.
But generically,
yeah.
So that's why you
mm-hmm.
have a second question.
Mm-hmm.
I also have another question, a different topic before we go on. If you go to the previous slide, you have an I in the exponent, right?
Yes.
So now, do I have a reason to expect that this integral, that this expectation value gives the right, at least on a lattice calculation, is to imagine that psi is just the integral over the rest of the infinite lattice which you have in ordinary RG calculus, with the same weight that you have in the bulk.
Mm.
So naively, you would say that maybe yes, maybe formally this reproduces, but there should be this boundary state should have just a structure of the type, the integration of the into the I direction. Whereas now you're assuming that it's real, so.
Yes, but even in like I will come to the theory. Yes, the so alpha certainly has an imaginary part, which comes from that, comes from integration of external variables. But it must also have a real part. There is always a real part that comes from this is the origin of the I epsilon in quantum field theory. Like when you do
so
the
in fact, so that's an important point.
So no, but it depends on what you take as your starting point. Can I just so I think that the way I understand this now is the following. We take the boundary state. If we take the boundary state formula as a fundamental, this is the form of boundary states, and alphas are arbitrary and real, or like real. The real part at least is arbitrary. The imaginary part is not arbitrary because it's constrained to be consistent under the formations of the boundary. If you integrate out some extra edges, then you need to have this. So the imaginary part of alpha comes from integration of the action. But the real part is it has a real part in principle. Like now, what is this real part? What determines it? I think that in general, you cannot say anything a priori to determine it. But in the particular case, when you have a flat, when you are in a flat lattice, even more specifically, a flat regular lattice, you can determine this by the requirement that eventually, when you do all the calculations and you get to the graviton propagator, and then you take the continuum limit, you get the same kind of graviton propagator as in quantum field theory with the correct I epsilon, which is the specification of asymptotic boundary conditions. That epsilon is a real part. That okay. Epsilon is a real part
so
in the alpha.
In this case, but in Lorentz, you can use that.
Well, yes, but something similar will happen in this case, I think. Yeah.
Very good. That's physically reasonable. And, but yeah, that's reasonable. Try to let
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there will be some
questions or discussion.
There will be something about that later, yeah. Okay, so now that we have the boundary state, we can go on to the evolution of observables. This, I've just repeated the formula I had before, the path integral over internal and boundary edges, a measure, which I'm not specifying. There is some discussion as to what is the correct measure in non-perturbative Rege calculus. I will not need to specify the measure for my purposes. The exponential of the action, and our boundary observable, and the boundary state that I've written in the previous slide. So for evaluating this, we use a stationary phase approximation, which is defined for integrals of this form, a function of a parameter, with a measure and an action q, which can be complex, because in this case, this q is given by the action and these things in the boundary state, the alpha l squared and the kl. And the domain of integration, x in this is given by all the l's and the boundary and internal l's, restricted by mu, because this measure mu restricts our boundary of integration to those configurations that satisfy a set of triangular inequalities for the configuration to be really a simplified geometry. And we use a large parameter lambda, because this is a stationary phase approximation for large lambda in this kind of expression, h bar to the minus 1 that appears in all terms. Like, so you could wonder whether this really makes sense because h bar is equal to 1. and my answer to this will be that this is typically what you do always in ordinary quantum mechanics. To do a stationary phase approximation, you first do it formally as an h bar to 0 limit. You get an asymptotic expansion out of that. But then, a posteriori, you need to check its regime of validity, its physical regime of validity, because of this just purely formal asymptotic expansion. And you need to find a dimension, a physical like parameter, which is really small and which gives you a regime of validity of this expansion. And this is exactly how we'll do it here. We'll find this a posteriori. So, well, this is just, you can skip this. This is an exact expression for the stationary phase approximation for this kind of integral. The important part is this, which is given by a sum of an asymptotic expansion in powers of h bar, so to say, with coefficients an. And the coefficients an are given by the function that is exponentiated there, q, and the measure function f, and the derivatives at the extremum that minimize the q for the with respect to all the variables the internal and the boundary variables.
So, the Reggie action is not like any other action, because you can just reabsorb each part. The definition of the edge length. So what I did,
you can always absorb each part somewhere if you want. Like, I don't see why it's different.
No, not always. That's the reason for it, not for every. And the other thing is that this is, I mean, there's another subject in this kind of integration as boundaries, so the stationary phase, you know. So is exact up to boundary terms.
No, the boundary terms that you're referring to are the boundary of the space of integration is given by whether this measure mu vanishes smoothly in the boundary. Yes, I'm assuming that mu vanishes smoothly in the boundary. Mm. But this is reasonable, like, I think. Because this is clear, we are clear that we're not talking about the boundary of space-time. We're talking about the boundary of this in the configuration space of Ls of the region, like the boundary of the domain in this space of edges, for which configurations are physical simplices, right?
And so you're excluding extremely large simplices by measures to vanish when the Ls become very large.
Well, no. The measure vanishes when the triangles become degenerate, right? When simplices become degenerate.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the L's are positive.
Sorry?
So L equals to 0 is also
one. Yes, L equals 0 is also one, yeah. Yeah, when triangles become degenerate.
But the measure does not vanish at the boundary.
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
It is an assumption, yeah. But I think that a reasonable measure for Reggie calculus will have to have this property. Yeah. But I don't think that one is a good choice.
The suggested choice is with inverse dependence on L. One over square root of the
lower
anyway. I think this is
right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, if they are boundary terms to the integral, they are also suppressed by one extra power of h bar. Then, so the lowest order doesn't change.
You also assume the measure to count the divergence when n goes to infinity.
Sorry.
So there's also divergence when you integrate n goes to infinity. The Reggie.
What kind of what do you mean a divergence?
Just go back. Your integral is not. So generically, if you integrate big L to infinity, you're going to see this integral is divergent.
If the bulk is not trivial, then we have H fixed integral form, I guess, but you discussed that.
This is a non compact integral, and you have an oscillatory factor. You don't have a factor like exponential minus n squared. Convergence. So unless you also tune the measure to contain some exponential minus n squared, this integral is usually
But these are general questions relevant to the measure of Reggie calculus. Like, I'm assuming a good measure that.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah. So it means that you're also assuming that you have a factor.
Yeah. So I'm assuming if you want that the measure is good enough that this integral has a meaning, like, and then I want to compute it by an approximation. But I'm assuming that this integral is such that we can give it a meaning, for example, by numerical integration.
Yeah. Now, I think it's a like, because if it has a cutoff, you cannot rescale. So there's a cutoff. So you're assuming there's a large cutoff for larger, like a factor. X measure minus n squared.
Well, there's as Matteo was pointing out, for the boundary L's, all of this is paid by the boundary.
Yeah, it's inside the bound.
Yes. Yeah, but he's going to talk about gauge fixing, I guess. So.
Hopefully. So if we let him a story to tell, hear the story, and then we can discuss. Please, and then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So.
Just, you know, that there are the divergences.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that the integral is that the measure is such that this integral has a meaning that is defined. like that you can do it numerically, for example.
Write it on the board, right.
Okay, so let's go through this this phase factor that we have there, which is the action, I times the Gaussian part of the boundary state and the phase part of the boundary state. And we need to find a point that minimizes this term and extremizes this. And that point will be the extremum at which this we need to evaluate this to find the asymptotic expansion. So the minimum of this part is given by the boundary edges at the classical values, and the extremum of the real part, like of this part, which is the proper stationary phase part of the approximation, is given by the derivative of the action with respect to the internal variables equal to zero, and the derivative of the action with respect to the boundary variables equal to the k factor. And this is why I needed a k factor. You see, this is this thing here, once we have set the boundary edges to the classical values, are just the Regi equation of motion for the boundary for the boundary condition. And this is a sort of consistent condition for the matching of the phases. And if we have chosen any other phase factor for the Gaussian, zero or any other numbers, not computed from a classical solution, then this equation will not be satisfied. And then there will be no point that extremizes the whole action, and the integral will be suppressed. So this is why this factor needs to be in the boundary state. So we have a solution for these equations, the classical equation of motion, with the caveats I mentioned before in the discussion. And this is true. There is a unique solution for the internal lengths if there are no flat patches on which you can move the edges freely around. But we'll come to that later.
You don't know if the solution is unique.
Okay, I was assuming that it was in a configuration for which this is true, and if this is not true, you just need to add more things in the boundary state to have enough to determine these equations.
Enough, let's assume that there's a unique solution. It's different than saying these are my equations, there is a unique solution. You agree?
Okay, if you want that, I think it's a very reasonable assumption, because otherwise, like, Regi calculus will be weird in the sense that you have like higher derivative terms. Like, the Regi equations are local, right? Shall we go on? So with this, you can evaluate all the coefficients that you need for computing observables order by order with asymptotic expansion. The one-point function for like the expectation value of a boundary edge is obviously given to the lowest order by the classical value, plus order h-bar corrections, which come because the boundary state is not the Gaussian that we have written is just a kinematical boundary state. It's not physically solved the dynamics, but it is so the correct values for the expectation value of the boundary edges come correct to the lowest order only. And the connected two-point function, the two-point function of two L's minus their single expectation values, which is what is related to the graviton propagator in the continuum, is given by h bar times this inverted Hessian, where this Hessian matrix H is the derivative of the action with respect to boundary edges, with respect to internal edges. We have like block matrix. This block is the boundary, this block is the external. And in the boundary part, we have also the alphas. And if there are no flat patches, so we don't have this translation invariance, this H is invertible, because the only extra problem with the Hessian of the Regi action is a conformal zero mode that it has, and this alpha is breaking it.
This is also an assumption. This is also exactly an assumption, a plausible assumption, but absolutely an assumption. Okay. There might be a residuous of diffeomorphism invariance even on curve of the discrete solutions. It is not known. And if there is, then H is not invertible.
Can we see where the assumptions take us?
No, for sure.
And of course, if you knew all of that.
Also, I thought you were computing around flat space then, right?
No. So this is a particular, I can compute around other spaces as well, but I can compute as well around flat space, and I will show you later how I do it. Yes, but I'll show you later how I do it around flat space, if you let me get there. For the moment, I'm assuming you have the Hessian space, but later I will show you how to do it in flat space.
So the statement that H is invertible depends on the earlier statement that the solution is unique, or is this a something to show, or a separate assumption?
So H will not be invertible if there was a continuum of physically different solutions. And this is one for my boundary variables, which is one possible way for the solution not to be unique. But I think it's very implausible that it could happen. So I don't know a proof that this doesn't happen for some case. Okay. Note that from these observers to the first order, they do not depend on an perturbative measure. So this is nice. Although it's what normally happens in this kind of expansion, which is like the loop expansion in quantum field theory. And another nice thing about this expression with the inverse of the Hessian is that you can rewrite it, shown to be equivalent to an expression which has the Hessian of the Hamilton function, only derivatives with respect to the boundary edges of the action taken as a function of boundary edges via the equation of motion. This is the Hamilton-Jacobi function. This is a very nice equivalence. And you can compare it with the expression from perturbative theory around a set of solutions everywhere, which has a Hessian of the action, plus some I epsilon that must be there, like because it's always there, like that has to do with the asymptotic boundary condition at infinity.
Like, in the Euclidean theory, where you have a problem h fixing, you don't need a plus I epsilon. In the Euclidean theory, the two-one function is 1/x² becomes 1/x² plus I epsilon in the Lorentzian case.
This is Euclidean theory with an imaginary action.
Yeah, it's an exclusion.
The action and the passing.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Riemannian theory, not Euclidean. Yeah.
That one would have no plus epsilon. Then if you do a weak rotation, but when you do it on the lattice,
I think that even in that case you need an epsilon because you need something to specify the vacuum at infinity, like otherwise what is okay, but then we can discuss it later. I agree that there's something here that is not completely clear, but we can discuss it later. Here's what you were saying before: if the boundary state is defined by inting or opting out external variables, we do obtain the other part of the Hessian, like the part that is missing here, the Hessian of the external action. With this epsilon that needs to be clarified exactly, but I think it has to be there. And then we recover the expression from perturbative theory, which is important because that one is known to recover the correct graviton propagator in the continuum limit. But yeah, this is very much work in progress, so I will not dwell too much on that. Now back to the expansion parameter and why the stationary phase approximation is justified. So when we have successive terms in the asymptotic expansion, we can compare them in this way. We can take the difference between the classical solution, which is the classical value, which is the first term, and the full asymptotic expansion, and divide it by the classical value to find a measure of how much this expansion is convergent, or whether we are in a dream in which this expansion is a good approximation, whether this expansion makes sense physically. And what we find when we do this is that this parameter that needs to be small is given by the Planck length squared divided by a lambda squared, which is a typical length scale of the classical solution we have picked upon. Now, the statement is that since the overall scale of the classical solution is determined by the boundary length, we can always make the boundary length large enough that this lambda bar, which has to do with the internal length scales, is also large enough for this to be small and for us to be in a good semiclassical regime. So a semiclassical regime is given by very large boundary lengths, large boundary lengths that are asymptotically larger than the Planck length. So now let's go to flat space. I still have several things to say, but he thought this point was important. I was trying to skip this, actually, but since he thinks it's so important, I will explain it a bit. So So when the background classical solution includes some flat regions, let's make it simpler and assume that all the internal part is flat. Like then there's no unique solution for internal edge links because we can translate the vertices around. We have several different there are continuum of values of the edge links that extremize the action. So we can make a separation in variables, in those variables that are translation variables and other variables. For example, in the simplest case, if we have only a single point inside, think if we have a single point inside a triangle in two dimensions, right? So then we have two dimensions to move this. So we have two unphysical degrees of freedom and one that is physical. So we make the separation. We treat one of these lengths as physical and the other two as gauge. We make an arbitrary separation and we integrate first over the physical one. So we leave for the last a set of 4q integrals over y variables, where this q is the number of vertices we can translate. And so 4q is the number of gauge degrees of freedom, if you want. We do first a well-defined stationary phase approximation for the other variables, which for fixed values of the y's will have a unique solution. And so that gives us this, which is a stationary phase asymptotic expansion. And then we have to do this averaging over the y's, if you want. But the nice thing is that to the lowest order, the result of this first integral is independent of the redundant variables, so the y integration is trivial. So the connected two-point function is unchanged from the general result. So the two-point function for a flat configuration is again given by this, the Hessian of the Hamilton function of the configuration, a function of boundary variables only. Yes, Simone?
One thing is confusing me here. Typically, the two-point function is a gauge-dependent quantity, right? Here you're sort of saying that it does not depend on...
Yeah, it does not. So the two-point function is, so this is a expectation value of boundary length, right? I think this is not gauge dependent. I think it's completely physical, like it's an observable. Like.
So you would not compare this to the graviton propagator then, let's see.
You will need to think a bit about how to compare to graviton propagator. But yeah, certainly this. Because these L's are observables, they are physical lengths. To compare to graviton propagator, you need to specify a coordinate system to define the metric, right? And there is where.
It would be invariant on the gauge transformations if you just move around internal points. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but since this is boundary things, it does not.
No, in general, one might think of standard random transitions as well, and not in the metric context, but in.
Yeah, but.
With a graviton propagator.
Yeah.
If you consider that gauge, then this
one. Yeah, but I'm thinking of the boundary edges as physical. I'm thinking that what we have boundary physical edges that are observables. Yeah, but yeah, there are different points of view you can take with respect to Regi calculus. And but I think that this point of view is consistent. Right. Okay. So incidentally, that last expression that I had about the Hessian of the Hamilton function proves triangulation independence as well for flat space. Not only it is independent of where the points are inside, but also of how you triangulate the interior, assuming it is flat. If you have two classical solutions representing the same physical geometry, where different triangulations that are related via Packner moves within the flat regions, then the first order semi-classical boundary correlations are the same on both. So we have triangulation independence for boundary correlations.
Is it 4D?
Yes.
That means you don't have propagating gravitational waves? That's more so free gravitational wave propagating the path.
Sorry?
Can you describe a free gravitational wave propagating in the path if you have triangulation independence?
So what I'm saying is that, let's be clear of what I'm saying. I'm saying that if you do, like, take boundary correlations, so suppose this is a flat configuration, right? And around this, I want to compute boundary correlations between this edge and this edge, with the fluctuations of this edge and this edge. What I'm saying is that this correlation will not depend on whether you have triangulated interior as this or as this, for example. I don't know. But if you do a Packner move that preserve the flatness, right? But I don't think this has to anything that I don't think this is at all incompatible with physical degrees of freedom. Like, I think it's a completely different question.
Oh, because it's typically when we say that it's triangulation independence, we also have assumed.
I don't mean triangulation independence in the strong sense that you talk about in Ponsano-Regev, for example. I'm just saying that the two-point function for boundary correlations and flats in the flat space, which is one particular background solution. This is not true for curved solutions. Yeah, but the boundary, the correlations around flat space are independent of how you triangulate your lattice interior. But this is
order.
Perfectly, yeah, to lowest order. To lowest order.
The rest
yeah. Okay. But and so this is, might be interesting for the discussions on spin forms at this point. Now let me, I still have a while, right? I want
yeah,
to talk about the, okay, excellent. More than enough. I have a few slides on the cosine problem on spin forms, which I think now this cosine problem used to exist. I think that now there's some question on whether it is really a problem, but I think that this still might be interesting. So this problem appears because the vertex amplitude for the Barrett-Crane model, well, and also happens in Ponsano-Regge and in many other models, has to do with the cosine of the Regge action of the configuration, and in the semi-classical limit in which all spins are large, the cosine plus pi over 4 plus some term that has to do with the degenerate configurations. And so this suggests that when we do a spin form model over many, like with many simplices, what we will have in the semi-classical limit will be sort of effectively equivalent to a Regge path integral, like the one we had before. But instead of the Regge action at this simplex, we have this cosine structure at this simplex, multiplied over simplices. So we have many, at each simplex, we will have a different cosine, and we have expanded into lots of terms with mismatching phases. So now I think that in the most recent calculations, this is shown not to happen, right? Like that you don't have this, you have only the Regge action, the cosine of Regge action for the whole configuration. Okay. Yes. But okay, I think this was an interesting question to explore, whether this formalism can sort of get rid of these extra terms, and the answer is that it can. So we are doing this a sort of heuristic way. We're assuming, we are not doing a spin form calculation here. We are assuming lots of things about the classical limit of spin forms. For example, that you can translate from spin form area variables to length variables. There is a huge problem here. This is just a sort of heuristic answers to investigate this particular problem, the cosine problem, and see whether it might be cured by the boundary state. And what we find is that, okay, so we have a product over simplex of this cosine structure, and we make this product into a sum of terms, which are sum over sine assignments, epsilon, of some factors times an exponential of an action, which is a sum of simplices of actions S epsilon, where S epsilon can be plus or minus one at each simplex, and meaning that you take different signs for the action at each simplex. Or it can also be zero, and in case it's zero, you don't take any action here, because it means you have chosen the degenerate term for that simplex. So you have all the possible terms here. Epsilon can be plus, minus, or zero. But you have the boundary state, which still choose exactly as before. It's the boundary state for Regge calculus and for a given Regge solution. So when we apply a stationary phase approximation to each of these terms in this sum over epsilon, the imaginary part picks the boundary length again in the classical configuration. The extremum equations for the action are just as before for each of the terms S epsilon. But now the system will in general not have solutions, because it is over the term. In this case, are the boundary curvatures for the Regge solution. They will not be the boundary curvatures for the solutions of the equation of motion of these other extra terms that have mismatching phases or whatever. So this will. Sorry. So these equations tell you solve the equations of motion for this strange action that has all the wrong phases, all the wrong signs, and whatever. So that will give you, maybe they will have no solutions, so that then you have no problem. Maybe they will have some solution, but that solution will, in general, obviously not have this particular property that the derivative of the external boundary length will be equal to those same numbers ki naught that happened for the true Regge solution.
Wait, there's another conjecture.
Yes, well, I mean, no,
it might be an isotherm.
Why not? Yeah.
Well, I think that it will be a miracle if it happened. Like, if you have too many conditions, like what?
It's intuitive. Like if you start with a particular free metric and it's a boundary of a solution of Einstein's equation, okay, and then you predict the extrinsic curvature, right, it's almost never going to be the case that if you take that same free metric and minus that extrinsic curvature, it's also going to be a solution.
Well, but here is sort of different. Here is like you're wondering whether inside in the bulk you can take two triangles and flip them around so that the dihedral angle has now become pi minus the initial dihedral angle inside in the bulk. And you're wondering whether this can be done without changing the configuration of the dihedral angles on the boundary.
Right. And okay,
another
small triangulation.
What you're saying is good in the continuum because of this movement.
in the discrete case, the things that create this main problem is the fact that suppose I want to glue two triangles. Without changing the geometry, I can glue them like that, or I can glue them like that. And from the continuum, this, you know, suppose I take a flat piece of paper, it's flat, right? I triangulate it. If I fold it along the edge of the triangulation, it's still a flat metric. But I'm starting to do my stuff in the wrong way with the wrong orientation. And in the continuum, you never go there, right? Because you have continuity in the region. But in this case,
so you're saying this problem to the extent that the classical Regi equation do not give good approximation to the fast time equation.
You have to show a fix the triangulation.
But then that's a large issue.
So that's the thing that you have to assume. So, I'm just saying that this is one of the things you have to worry when you go discrete. That all these things that are nice about the continuum, are just much more difficult. So, that's why I say it's a conjecture, it's an assumption. It's a nice assumption.
No, just the conclusion.
Okay, so again.
Huh? You can keep the solution a bit and then go to the conclusions yet. Yes.
Okay, so let's go to the next.
Yeah. So if you buy this, then the conclusion is of this part is that the contribution from non-trivial terms are suppressed. So there's a classical version of observables for this structure with cosines. It simply will match that of conventional Regi calculus. And so some of your results. The boundary state formalism can successfully be applied to extract the semi-classical regime from the non-perturbative Regi path integral with arbitrary triangulations. And we can recover from the results from conventional perturbative formulation around our chosen classical solution. Second point is that the flat space degeneracy does not affect the results because the boundary state, and this is basically because the boundary state is picking us at the desired geometry. So even if it does not tell us what are the values of the edges, then this thing has this freedom for the interior is not relevant. You can compute boundary correlations without resolving this ambiguity. They come out unambiguous. And the third point is about the cosine. If you do a cosine ansatz for the semi-classical regime of spin-form models, then you find the results are unchained from conventional Regi calculus. So some open things, like besides maybe working on all the conjectures that Laurent was pointing at. But what I think is, like, what I think is our important open problem is finish establishing the relation between the perturbative and boundary state formulation with fully recovering the graviton scaling with distance. Though I say that this was mostly done, this is very much work in progress. There are things that I put on the site that I've just figured out yesterday, so to say. So there are things I still want to think about distance, especially the role of that I epsilon that we can discuss later. Then obviously we'll need to apply this to serious spin-form models. Especially useful for this will be the path integral formulation that Laurent and Florian have. And we also need to understand better how the triangulation refinements work, whether we can connect this to the transition group, whether we can go all the way to something related to effective field theory, and so on. So to end, I would like to sketch the piecewise limit research program that I would like to have from going from full loop quantum gravity and spin forms to conventional effective field theory for gravity, which is very far away. But I think that if you break it into parts and you do each part separately, then you'll find that maybe it's not so difficult as you might find. First, you go from loop quantum gravity and spin forms to loop quantum gravity and spin forms with semi-classical boundary states, which you need to figure out how to construct for what you want. But there are problems there, sure. But it seems possible that it can be done. Then you connect these to boundary state Regi calculus in the large limits of spin forms. Then, this is the blank field by this talk, you go from boundary state Regi calculus to perturbative Regi calculus. And finally, you go from there to effective field theory, like in a suitable continuum limit. I think that this is a good research program. That we call
thank you.
First of all.
I just want to understand the last statement about the cosine. Is it a leading order statement or is it true at any order?
So what you have is that. So it is true at the leading order. It is true at all orders if you assume something strongly about the measure emerging from spin forms. If you assume that this So I have done this ansatz for simple models that leads to a Reggie-like path integral, and I have a sort of emergent measure here, which I call mu tilde, and it's times all these factors that come from simple models. I don't know. So there is an emergent measure from simple models. If this measure has the property that Laurent was pointing out before, that it vanishes smoothly in the boundary, then there are no boundary contributions, and then you can say that this is true at all orders. Like that the extra terms, that all the epsilon terms which have no extremum, are suppressed faster than any power of each part from the semiclassical limit. But if this measure has not this nice property, then you can only state something about the leading order.
Huh? Would mean that there's basically no difference physically in terms of two wave functions between having a cosine and having the exponential.
Well, if you take boundary states that are nice, that pick you in the right in configurations where all the
So you talked about this gauge invariance. First of all, in integrating out the gauge models, do you take into account that your measure has to vanish? It seems to me that the measure will exclude some of these gauge configurations. In particular, for instance, do you, I don't know if your measure excludes this, but will they let some of the internal points come outside of the region, or do they all have to stay inside of the region?
So the measure assumes I have a fixed, I'm assuming I'm working with fixed triangulation, and that measure vanishes when the triangles become degenerate. So a point cannot escape from the interior to exterior, because then you will need to pass by a degenerate configuration, right?
Well, yeah, but it could, of course, continue on the other side.
Yeah.
But then you would perhaps get a rather complicated dependence in the shape.
Yeah, but basically, for the nice thing for this is that you do not need to assume anything very strong about the measure. For example, I think that it is plausibly true for Reggie calculus that the measure does not give equal weight to convolutions that are equivalent in the sense that are just translations. But even if this is not so, it does not ruin this calculation. And the reason is basically, okay, take this to the lowest order. So the lowest order of this A naught coefficient here, is just the measure evaluated at the classical at the configuration you are times, the first term will be the measure at the term that you want, and there's something like this, which is the observable, the evaluation of the observable, the Hessian of the function of the action or whatever, right? And the important thing is that the Hessian of the Hamilton function does not depend on the position of the internal variables, because it's a function of boundary variables only. So that one goes out from this integral. Now the measure may depend on the y's, on the position of the gauge variables, but once you have taken out the observable, this integral is just equal to the partition function z, so it just cancels out.
Yeah. One more thing connected with this. These are flat configurations, but then you have almost flat ones, right? And you would expect somehow there to be some sort of almost gauge models for that. But you still play the same game and think
so. I'm not sure. I do not follow. I know that these people talk about the things as almost gauge modes, but they don't really understand what you mean. Like, what do you mean by this? If it is not flat, then it's not flat, right? So
there should be some modes if it's almost flat where you change an edge length quite a bit, but it has very little effect on the action.
I expect
flat
that
planar curvature on one, like if you, because you're higher dimensions, so you can have flat planar curvature on one thing and the planar curvature perpendicular to it not be not flat, but then you can have gauge, the gauge group is reduced.
I'm not sure I understand you. I don't know what you will do with your starting point configuration as one of these almost flat things. Like, I don't know if you can make a variation of this.
comments, questions? Jürgens was so heated during the talk, now there are no more.
Yeah, they exhausted all the heat already.
Okay. So if not, let's thank.
Okay.